Good morning, post council members. It is November 9th, 2022 at 9 a.m. We're meeting at the Public Safety Education and Training Center located at 410 West, 9800 South in the post council training room. As far as those that are excused, Sheriff Nate Curtis and John Crowley, as a proxy, Director Knorr will be standing in place of Director Nelson. I need an approval of the September 27th, 2022 minutes and the October 12th, 2022 minutes. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
I have a motion from Spence Austin. Do I have a second? Director Knorr, a second. Any further discussion? Hearing no comments, I'll ask for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. We'll go ahead and move to Marcus Yockey for post-curriculum 2022-23 update and presentation for special function officer.
And it also includes Leo, so I'll throw that in there.
Oh, sorry about
that.
Make sure
we're on the, no, you're good. I'm just making sure Chris flips it over. Okay, so as you may recall, Chairperson Carpenter asked me to present on the new way we do curriculum here at Post. So I'm going to walk through a few different things on how we develop curriculum here and the new way we're doing it here. And then we do have just a few minor changes, not really requesting hours, but just a few minor changes that we just wanted to present to the council. So when we develop courses, this is everything that we're looking at when we're going into courses. We have a lot of information that we consider when we develop any of our courses, right? So we consider our legal review. We're trying to develop a learner's guide, or we're trying to develop research-based practices. We're trying to develop research-based instructional strategy. One of the newer approaches we're trying to develop is this blended delivery, which is a hybrid version of dealing with an online approach at first, and then getting them priming the cadets with information at the very beginning, and then re-engaging them in the classroom so that we can deal with re-emphasizing what they're learning on the online version. We're also working on the integrated curriculum, meaning that all our curriculum is connected together. So it's not just standalone courses that we're looking at. We're actually trying to make sure everything flows together so that the cadets are ready to hit the road once they're out of the academy. So this is everything that goes into it. Right now, unfortunately, with the majority of our classes, we're only able to accomplish four of these at this point because we simply don't have the staff. And we've actually have a request in with the governor's office for a content developer that should be able to help us out with this hybrid learning approach. But what we've been able to accomplish so far in the majority of courses that we're working on is the legal review, the research-based practices, and the research-based instructional strategy, as well as the instructional guide. Some of the things, our assessments, we have improved greatly over this last couple of months. We've been working on the testing process to ensure that everything is valid, everything, all the test questions are actually matching up with curriculum. But the reason I wanted to present this first before I get into some of the curriculum items and the course objectives is I want to show what all goes into a course. And the mastermind behind this is John Jacobs. He has a master's in education. He's currently working on his doctor's degree in education, and he does it's all through course development. And John is just a genius in this regard. So he also does a lot of stuff for iAtalyst, and just giving you some information in regards to that. So the next thing I want to show you, the class that we actually have completed almost completely, other than our evaluation. So our evaluation on this last one right here, the evaluation would be conducted about 6 months post the academy. And what we would be doing is we'd be reviewing with our FTOs and with the cadets whether or not they're actually remembering information. And so that's the one area we still haven't been able to finalize. We're getting there through Director Garcia and through Lieutenant Newland. We've been doing debriefings with our classes, and we're identifying gaps, loopholes, areas that we have deficiencies in, but we need to get a better evaluation whether or not they're actually retaining the information. So in regards to the next slide I'm going to show you, that's the evaluation is the only area that we are lacking in this class. This is one class that we are completely done on, our human trafficking. So what we do is we teach it we have five modules online, and the cadet will go through five modules at the very beginning, completely by themselves, and then they will take an online self-assessment, an online test, to determine whether or not they're actually retaining the information. Then what happens is we bring them into the classroom, and we have them, at that point, we do a reinforcement activity. Generally, what we've done for this class is we've done like Family Feud. We've done a few other types of presentations just to see if they're retaining the information from the online course. And then we jump into a classroom scenario-based discussion. So this scenario is actually based on a real case study that happened in regards to human trafficking. We have the cadets break up into groups, identify whether or not they can identify what they would charge this individual for, what is missing in information as far as the investigation, how to proceed with it. And then we will debrief the class entirely based on with a legal analysis and determine whether or not they're actually understanding what they need to as far as the scenario. During that class, we also have developed student guides and a Quizlet flashcards that we've provided to those cadets so that they're able to retain that information a little better. And then at the very end, we do have these benchmark assessments that we deal with that they're able to test on, and then we have the final comprehensive assessment. So again, this course is our most complete course. The other courses that I've talked about were about four or five of those of this slide right here that we've been working on. So let me show you just a few of those really quick. Everything that we do, we maintain on our live link for the cadets and for our instructors. So these are all our courses that we have. This includes both our SFO, LEO, and then if you look at the core 3000 numbers, those are the BCO course numbers. So everything, all our objectives are retained online. And when we develop courses, so I'm going to show you an older version of a course. This is Crimes Against Person 1. So if you look at this course, we have the course goal, course direction, learning objectives. If you look at the objectives, essentially all it was is just the statute and then verbatim recitation of the statute. Doesn't really help the cadets as far as the objectives because, okay, you're supposed to learn the statute, awesome. But as far as having that as far as an objective or anything like that and providing this to facilitators, the actual instructors, this doesn't really help them. So what we did is we took this and we created a two-part document. So we have, I'm going to pull up what we have right now against, and it's changed, the legislature did change from crimes against the person to crimes against the individual. Always have to be PC. So, it also makes more sense because person can be an entity. So we have right here crimes against the individual. This is what our curriculum looks like now. We have now developed outcomes for the course. We now introduce prerequisites. That's how we're tying everything in together, making sure that we're understanding, hey, they need to have the criminal code first before they have the persons. We identify that how we are going to assess the information, and then we identify the curriculum in a cleaner format to identify what we actually need them to learn. So this is what the cadets see. This is the objectives they have to learn. What we then do is we produce a facilitator's guide for the instructor, which we never had this before. Nice legal jumbo up at the very beginning, saying it's all fair use and everything. We provide them exactly how they're supposed to instruct this class, the timing, the pace, what materials they need, the breaks. The course curriculum goes back to that other one, and then we get into course delivery. We give them activities that they're supposed to be completing during these various things, whether it's a statutory breakdown, whether it's a scenario that the instructor is supposed to be helping them out with. And We provide all this to the instructor. So that's the crimes against the individual course as far as the facilitator guide. The other ones that we've developed, and this is a little more comprehensive, we have, for instance, conflict management right here. In this class, this is one of our longer ones. This is a 12-hour course. And this is, I'm going to show you the research aspect on this one. So we have the course curriculum, the outcomes, and the direction they're supposed to head. But then we've also gone through and we've provided all the research to back our objectives. And we've done this through all the best practices, either developed through the national standard or through other police academies. We've also contacted a few sheriffs, chiefs, and whatnot. I use Ken Wallentine as a resource because he's a great resource in regards to research that he's done. And we then develop this research and write this out so that when an individual is teaching this course, they actually have the information to back them up. And this is all referenced. This one is 11-point font, but you can see how lengthy it is. We're looking at about 70 pages just to provide to those instructors. And the reason we're doing this is when we were just providing these objectives to these to the various satellite academies, we have about 12 satellite academies. You can imagine they have the objectives, but they're not the consistency and instruction is lacking because we don't have the research there. We don't have how they're supposed to be teaching it. All it is, hey, go teach this. But we actually don't have a mechanism actually getting it together. The hope on all our law courses, right now we just have a stopgap in place so that our legal instructors can do this. But our desire is to get everything into that hybrid version. So we prime them at first, and then we have them come into class, and we have the legal instructors actually go over scenarios so that they're understanding the law completely. By the time they hit that road, they're going to be solid. So that's what we're hoping for. There was a few other classes that I quickly wanted to show you. One of the classes when we were doing the debriefing with the FTOs that we noticed that we were quite deficient in is our report writing course. So we developed our, this is what it looks like right now. If you look at the objectives, it just identifies filled notes. We have a few, a little bit of information. So we've gone through, we've identified with our new one, we've identified the actual objectives that we actually need, the prospective audience in the reports, case law to back us up, which law we need to cite. We've identified the purpose of filled notes, how to actually put what to actually include in filled notes. And then what we have done is we have now included this. This is actually available to all our instructors through the entire state, all our academies. And this is the facilitator's guide with the research. And we have an active voice assignment, passive voice assignment, and stuff like that. But this is all the research that backs up how to write a police report, what should be in a police report, all that stuff. Okay. With that information, is there any questions or concerns as far as course development, what needs to be included, or anything like that?
Just a curiosity question on the online portion of that. Is that done at home, or is it done so on your own time, or is that more here and more structured?
It is. We would generally have it be as a homework type assignment, so they'd be doing it at home. We sometimes have hours during the academy that we can flex, that they're able to do it in class or at home, but we generally have them do at home. And then again, the main point is following up afterwards. It's not just, hey, take an online class and then click through it as quickly as you can, because they're not going to retain anything. We actually expect them to come back and actually do assignments and actually understand what is being taught. Any other questions or concerns?
I just wanted to chime in on that. So that's called like flex pedagogy, right? And there's lots of research that supports it. So I mean, it's a great approach.
Yes.
And you learn on your own, and then you go back into the classroom and reevaluate.
And hopefully, that's the approach we want to go for all our courses. Right now, we just need a little bit more personnel. So hopefully that, with the request from the governor's office, we can get that. And it's just time, right? It just takes a little bit of time to do it. So
On the satellite academies, if I understood correctly, there's a little bit of inconsistency with the instructors.
Potentially. And that's, so that's what we're trying to rectify with these instructor evaluator guides and whatnot, is we're trying to actually give them, hey, this is how a course should be taught, instead of, hey, here's the objectives, good luck.
Does that, as the testing come out, does it show that we're having a higher failure rate in the satellites, or is it reflective of?
What do you mean?
Meaning if the training is inconsistent or potentially.
Oh, yes. So we can show that based on our numbers, we have a higher passing rate here at the academy based on we know the curriculum, right? We understand how to teach this information. We've got our instructors up to speed. Unfortunately, we are getting that. We're trying to get there with our satellite academies, but we do have a slightly higher fail rate with our satellite academies. And I don't want to say correlation. I don't want to say, yes, it's because of this, but it could be one factor, yes.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions or concerns?
No question other than a support. I love the blended edition that you did. Public ed, secondary high school, as well as higher ed are still doing that based on, of course, COVID, right? So preparatory for what is going on in the whole educational system. I think with the addition of that blended curriculum piece, you guys are going to support all types of learning catastrophes that may or may not happen in the world. So, well done.
Thank you.
Just give you just a really quick side note. Director Garcia and former Director Stevenson went to down in Texas.
The IATLIS.
IATLIS conference. And so what they did is they were actually talking about this curriculum and talking about the new approaches to curriculum. What we identified during that that meeting is Utah is actually far advanced. We're actually further along than almost every other state. And we want to be further along than every other state. And so hopefully with this development, I mean, we have a smaller staff than a lot of other academies, a lot of other posts in various states. But hopefully with this, we can become better than every other state in the nation. So
one thing to add on this with the curriculum. Previous curriculum had statutes listed throughout, right? And we all know that the legislature changes statutes from time to time, and that tends to foul up the curriculum and causes repeatedly going through and correcting small problems, right? And that's something we haven't been able to do in the past because of staffing issues, right? So it's been kind of Band-Aids here, Band-Aids there. The way this is set up now, there are no statutes listed in this curriculum. So it lists the actual violation itself by name. So therefore, if there's any changes in statute numbering, we don't have to go back through and correct things. It's I don't want to say it's a self-sustaining model, but it requires less maintenance throughout to keep this relevant and up to date. So it's a lot of work in the front end, but it will be very beneficial on the back end.
One more thing, I just saw Sheriff Sparks, and I know he teaches up at Weber, and this just reminded me. We also do an area where we were deficient in the past, just again due to resources, where we weren't able to produce a lot of base PowerPoints and have that uniform approach. We are trying to develop better PowerPoints for the majority of classes, at least get a base one. They can personalize them. They can add their own information later on. But that's what we've been also developing, and hopefully they've worked out, Sheriff Sparks. And
sure.
So that's what we've been approaching. So any other questions on the curriculum before I request for changes?
Great work.
Okay, awesome. The changes that we are requesting as far as for the next little bit is what we've identified. The first thing is we're looking to swap victimology. So we have two classes right now. We have victimology and we have trauma-informed policing. What we've identified is actually, so victimology is currently being taught in our SFO, and trauma-informed policing is currently being taught in our LEO block. What we've identified is actually trauma-informed is a prerequisite, is a class that actually should be taught at before. So what we would request, and it doesn't change any hours or anything like that, we're essentially swapping victimology for trauma-informed policing. So moving trauma-informed policing to our SFO block from our LEO and vice versa. Any questions or concerns?
SFO missing out on the victimology class? Is that...
They will get the basics, again, in trauma-informed policing. You'll get the majority of information. Victimology is going to be a little more centered on the investigation aspect. So it's going to be more law enforcement-centric, whereas trauma-informed policing, they will still get all the basics that they need as far as how to approach a victim, how to make sure not to re-traumatize, and all that information. But yes, they'll still get the basic information. The victimology right now is just so law enforcement investigative centric. It doesn't make sense. We do need to switch it. So, okay, I'll just present all of these, and then if we want to make a motion, I will look at Chairperson Carpenter. So, the other additions that we're looking at is one gap we noticed is our emergency medical response series. So we have a series of courses that we currently teach. Right now, we have 6 hours in our SFO block and 8 hours in our LEO block. So our courses right now in our SFO block is emergency medical response. We have first aid, which we dropped down to 4 hours just a little bit ago. And then we have our critical tactical care. What we're looking at doing is expanding this a little bit. Not, again, asking for additional hours because we have 2 hours that we moved to review. But we would be increasing our SFO instruction on emergency medical response to two additional hours. And how we would do that is we'd be shifting around a few of the objectives, information that is taught in the classes. We'd be also adding an hour bloodborne pathogen class. And it's in a completely online class that's already developed and that's already in place. And then we also have the naloxone for opioid overdose, which is also already online and already in place. Right now, we just have them available, but we haven't had them as part of the curriculum, as part of our objectives. So we would look to add those two courses and then just essentially divvy up the rest of the emergency medical response to make sure everything flows properly, to make sure our prerequisites are being taught right. You don't want to learn how to do a tourniquet before you actually do some of the other stuff, right? So we want to make sure all our classes are flowing correctly, and that's what we're looking at. And then the last proposal we have isn't really a request for hours or anything like that. It's just more of an informational piece. We have our wellness and resiliency courses. We have currently 4 hours in our SFO and 4 hours in our LEO class. With our healthy lifestyles, physical fitness, healthy lifestyle, stress management, and then our mental preparedness skills. What we're looking at doing is to get more in line with the new movement is right now. With the mental resiliency and also the officer wellness, that's the big focus. I don't know if you guys have seen that over the last year and a half, as far as making sure our officers are taken care of and making sure they're resilient. And so we'd essentially mirror classes, one for SFO and LEO, and reinforce the information in our LEO block. So that is the presentation as far as curriculum changes. Any questions or concerns?
One question, going back to the opioid overdose course. Is there also a section discussing officer safety with fentanyl and drugs that you know, just being exposed to can have a really fatal...
I will have to check on that. So John Jacobs he's an individual of many traits. So he's also a paramedic as well. So he's the one that's kind of pushing this. I will check with him in that regard. I'm not sure on the top of my head because this is his information, but that would make complete sense as far as adding that. So
I think just adding some fentanyl-specific information for officers, just because I worry with how toxic that is just through the skin, some of the impacts that as that becomes more pervasive, it will have on our officers specifically as well as the public.
Completely agree.
Sir?
I'll have to look, but that may already be in our familiarization with drugs
okay.
Class as well. But that's definitely something to add if it's not there, but it may already be in that course.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any questions or concerns? So could I get a motion in regards to these suggested curriculum changes?
Do I have a motion to approve the suggested curriculum changes?
Move to approve.
Sheriff Sparks?
Second.
Second was?
Second.
Any further comments? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you so much.
Great job. We'll now move to disciplinary cases. Michael Gadd will be presenting.
Just as an initial matter, I've been a volunteer instructor for the Academy here and also the Salt Lake City Satellite Academy for the last 4 years. I teach the controlled substances course. My background is I prosecuted at the DEA for the last 8 years, and I cover fentanyl in great detail there, including the use of naloxone powders, vent hoods, things like that. I don't remember if it's specifically in the curriculum, but in today's day and age, I can't have an officer leaving the academy without knowing some of those very basic but essential principles. As far as disciplinary matters, could we first call the case of Chadwick Adamson? Mr. Adamson is represented by counsel. I see he's also present. Chadwick Adamson was arrested for DUI and a traffic offense. He was later charged with those same violations. Mr. Adamson pleaded guilty to an amended charge of impaired driving, and the traffic offense was dismissed with prejudice. Mr. Adamson resigned from UDC as a result of this incident. Mr. Adamson did not participate in Garrity interviews with either his home agency or Post. The charge of DUI was substantiated as a result of the Post investigation. This is a Category D offense. The guideline baseline is 12 months. The range is between 3 and 30 months. Post is recommending 24 months. Mr. Adamson resigned from his agency. That was on the 8th of March, 2022. We're here by way of default. And I'll note as aggravating circumstances that this DUI offense included a traffic accident, that Mr. Adamson was in uniform at the time of the offense, and that his blood alcohol content was 0.16. Unless the council has any questions for me, I'll turn this podium over to Mr. Adamson and his defense.
Thank you for seeing me today. I wasn't planning on showing up. As far as this incident goes, there's a lot of things that aren't in the report. First of all, there was no traffic accident. What happened was I went straight from work to pick up a friend from the bar, had too many to drink, got in a little argument. I got into my vehicle. I backed out. The alarm went off in my truck. I thought maybe I hit somebody. I parked my truck, realizing then at that time that I needed a ride. I arranged for a ride. I went down to this parked vehicle. This lady was coming out of a bike shop. And I tried to explain to her, is this your car? She ran to her vehicle. I went behind her vehicle to see if I hit her bumper. I didn't. And she called the police at that time. And that's when they talked to me. And at that moment, I informed them why I was talking to this individual. She was scared. And that is how they became knowledgeable that I actually even drove my vehicle from one parking spot to another. Since this incident, I have sought counseling. Being prior service to the military, I have got services through the VA. I talked to a therapist, and this has been a rough 8 months for me. I do get benefits to the VA now. They see a direct correlation from the time I left Iraq and subsequently lost my job, my marriage, and this last 8 months has been a milestones for me. I learned a lot, and I'm in a lot better place. And again, I wasn't going to show up today, but I just thought that I owed it to myself, my department that I was with for 23 years. And I just wanted you guys to know, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But I just wanted you guys to know more of the story than just what he said. So, counsel, anything you want to say?
Yes, Mr. Adamson, just wanted you all to know that it was a reported accident. There was an understanding that there was an accident. That's why the officer went over there, but there was no actual damage to the vehicle. He also understands that there's an upper deviation because he was in uniform and that there was a high BAC. What he's hoping for is that rather than a two-year suspension, that there'd be maybe a downward deviation to hopefully an 18-month suspension. The baseline's 12. And with that, we're willing to answer any questions that you may have. Okay.
Hearing no questions, I'll go ahead and ask for a motion.
Move to accept recommendation.
I have a motion to move to accept recommendations from Colonel Rappage. I have a second from Sheriff Sparks. Any further discussion? For the record, Travis Knorr will recuse himself. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion passes.
Thank you, Counsel. The only question I'd have, so you actually resigned on 3-8 of 22, is that correct?
Correct.
An admin leave was on 2-11-22. Were you paid during that time?
Yes.
So you were paid, so you went on the actual unpaid resignation at 3-8-22. So I just, for the motion, I would suggest that time start on that date for the time that you were off.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Separation date. Thank you.
Let's next call the matter of Alexandra Cespedes. Ms. Cespedes has an attorney present. I don't believe she's present.
She's not present.
Ms. Cespedes was charged with 5 counts of electronic communication harassment. A domestic violence attribute was attached to those charges. The charges stemmed from 2 episodes during which Ms. Cespedes sent 17 text messages to a former romantic partner after the relationship had ended. The former romantic partner told Cespedes to not contact her on 2 separate occasions. Those were the beginnings of the 2 episodes that later were alleged in the notice of agency action. Ms. Cespedes, in her criminal case, pleaded no contest to 2 of the 5 charges. Her pleas were held in abeyance. Ms. Cespedes resigned from her agency and did not participate in a Garrity interview with Post. At the time of the offense, Ms. Cespedes was working for St. George PD. She had 2 years of service. This is a Category D offense. The baseline's 12 months. The range is between 3 and 30 months. Post is recommending 18 months. In this case, Ms. Cespedes resigned from her agency on January 13th of 2022. We're here by way of a waiver. You'll notice that Post's recommendation is above the guideline range. That's because of the multiple counts. Unless there's any questions for me, I'll turn it over to Mr. Evershed. Please.
I have a question. Do we know the nature of the texts for them to be harassment-based?
Yeah, so I can answer that with a legal answer rather than a factual answer. If under our law, if you're told to stop making contact and you continue to make contact, that in itself is a violation of the statute.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay.
Counsel?
Yes, thank you. Ms. Cespedes has just wanted me to convey a couple things. One, just so you all know, the case is now dismissed. It's a plea in abeyance. The case is all over. And then the other thing that was really important for her, for you all to know, that this was not a domestic relationship. She did not actually plead in court to domestic violence. She pled in court to electronic communications harassment. That's because she believed, and there wasn't really evidence to support anyway, that they were cohabitants, that they didn't live together. There was no sexual relationship. There was no, they're girlfriends. And so that was something that she wanted you all to know. She understands that there's an upward aggravating deviation from 12 months to 18 months because of the multiple counts. She's hoping that you would have a baseline 12-month suspension. Thank you.
By girlfriends, you mean that they were friends who were girls?
Yeah.
Were they romantically involved?
So they were romantically involved, but to be a cohabitant, you have to be actually and married or have children together or have a sexual relationship together. So it wasn't cohabitant, which meant it wasn't domestic violence, but it was still romantic.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for counsel? Hearing none, I'll call for a motion.
I'll make the motion.
A motion from Chief Soap.
Because of the continued harassment that she continued to do over and over after being told to stop, I'd recommend that we go with the 1.5-year suspension as recommended by Post.
I have a motion to accept post recommendation. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Second, Chief Swanson. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you, Council.
If I can excuse.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. All the best.
Let's next call the matter of Mr. Richard Eubanks. I don't believe he's present, nor do I believe he has counsel present, and I see no one. Mr. Eubanks was investigated by a local police agency for driving under the influence of alcohol. The investigation disclosed that on March 26 of this year, Mr. Eubanks had consumed multiple alcoholic beverages prior to driving and was involved in a minor traffic accident. Investigating officers observed signs of impairment, including the odor of an alcoholic beverage. Mr. Eubanks performed poorly on the standard field sobriety tests. An intoxilizer test revealed Mr. Eubanks had a breath alcohol content of 0.232. At the time of this offense, Mr. Eubanks was employed by the Provo Constable's Office. He had been there for 1 year. This is a Category A offense, and I'll skip to aggravating circumstances because that is why we ended up in Category A. Mr. Eubanks has two prior DUI offenses. They occurred outside of the state of Utah. The baseline here is revocation. The range is between a 3-year suspension and revocation, and POST is recommending revocation. In this incident, Mr. Eubanks resigned. He resigned June 28th of this year. We're here by way of default. Unless the council has any questions for me, I'm happy to submit it. Please.
The two priors, their convictions.
Yes, sir.
Any further questions? Hearing none.
Oh, the two priors, were they also a high BAC?
I don't know the answer to that. If I did, I'd hesitate to say it because it's not contained in the notice of agency action, and where we're here by way of default, we accept those facts as they are.
Thank you. With that, I'll call for a motion.
Motion to accept post recommendation of revocation.
Second.
I have a motion from Chief Swanson to accept revocation and Councilperson Stevens to second. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you.
Let's next call the matter of Gavin Hanselman. Mr. Hanselman's present, as is his counsel. After first being warned to stop teasing another officer, to leave the other officer's property alone, and to create a positive work environment, Mr. Hanselman loaded an office printer with paper that already displayed a printed image of the other officer. And when documents were printed at the office, the documents were printed on paper bearing that other officer's image. On November 21st of last year, Mr. Hanselman's supervisor asked Mr. Hanselman if Mr. Hanselman had done anything to the other officer. Mr. Hanselman said no. Had a crew meeting later on November 25th where Mr. Hanselman was present with other officers. The supervisor again asked Mr. Hanselman if he had done anything to the other officer. The supervisor asked specifically if Mr. Hanselman had placed paper bearing the other officer's image into the printer. Mr. Hanselman responded he did not do anything to the other officer. The following day, Mr. Hanselman contacted his supervisor and admitted he put papers into the printer tray, these papers. During a subsequent post interview, Mr. Hanselman denied knowing that the supervisor had asked him about putting paper in the printer tray both times the supervisor asked. Mr. Hanselman indicated he thought the supervisor was asking about something someone else did directly to that other officer. Mr. Hanselman explained he found out the supervisor was inquiring about paper in the printer tray after the crew meeting on November 25th. And then he contacted his supervisor to take responsibility. At the time of this matter, Mr. Hanselman was employed by the Highway Patrol and had been so for 6 years. This is a Category E offense. The baseline is 6 months. The range is between a letter of caution and 18 months. In this case, POST is recommending a letter of caution. As a result of the agency's investigation, Mr. Hanselman was given an 8-hour suspension. He left his agency in May of this year, and we're here by way of a default. As maybe an explanation as to POST's recommendation, certainly it comes from the facts and the nature of the allegations, but also because of ambiguity in Guideline Note 4. something that's on our agenda that we'll cover after the disciplinary cases, but that played a role in our recommendation. If the council has any questions for me, I'm happy to try to answer them.
For the record, I have two recusals, Colonel Rappage and Chief Soph. Chief Swanson, do you have a question?
Just curious if this case even really fits. You know, the guideline says a mandatory report to post.
When you say the guidelines, help me understand what you mean. Do you mean the sentencing guidelines?
Statute.
The statute.
And specifically 1G? I know it was looked at closely before the referral was made, and I understand the basis for that referral. As far as whether or not it fits, I suppose that's a decision above my pay grade, but in my view it does.
The statute says that if an officer is found by a court or a law enforcement agency to have knowingly engaged in conduct that involves dishonesty or deception in violation of a policy of a peace officer's employer or in violation of state or federal law.
So it seems to me that this would be one that maybe a couple of years ago before the change in the statute may not have come to post, but would be appropriate to come to post now under the new statute.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Counsel, would you like to present?
I'm not going to take up too much of your time. I just want you guys to know I take responsibility for my actions that brought me here today. I've always tried to hold myself to a high standard, to be upfront and honest about everything. I'm not perfect. I admit that I made mistakes. I continue to try to better myself, become a better person, a better cop. I hope that the council will allow me to continue to work towards that goal.
And then I just want to emphasize that with respect to the default, we don't disagree with the recommendation of the council. And so we support that, believe that it's appropriate, and would ask that that's what you guys do.
Any questions for council or Mr. Eubanks?
What's that?
Could you council's name?
Minister Nelson.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Hearing none, I'll call for a motion.
I'd like to move that we accept post-recommendation of a federal caution.
I've got a recommendation to accept post-council's recommendations from Sheriff Rigby. Do I have a second?
Second
from Dr. Sween. Any further discussion? That'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you.
Let's next call the matter of Kevin Harmon. Mr. Harmon, if you're present, if you'd come forward. I've not seen him, and no one is coming forward now. SFO Kevin Harmon was investigated by a local police agency for electronic communication harassment while attending a satellite academy seeking LEO certification. The investigation disclosed that on March 19th of this year, Mr. Harmon got into an argument with his ex-girlfriend over their relationship status. Mr. Harmon became upset. Mr. Harmon's ex-girlfriend told Mr. Harmon to quit contacting her, and he continued to send multiple text messages. This is not a case where a DV tag was applied in the criminal matter. At the time, Mr. Harmon was not employed. He was a cadet. He had 0 years of service. This, like our previous electronic communications harassment case, is a Category D offense. The baseline here is 12 months. The range is between 3 and 30 months, and POST is recommending the baseline 12 months. We're here by way of default. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
With him being a cadet, it'd be 1 year suspension until he can re-enter the academy, correct?
We're taking action on his SFO certification. As far as when he can re-enter, I'd have to defer to Director Garcia or one of these folks.
He would be eligible after his suspension's up for the year. He could re-enter an LEO block, yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Hearing none, I'll go ahead and call for a motion.
I move we accept the post recommendation of 1 year suspension.
Councilperson Stevens makes a recommendation to accept post council recommendation. Do I have a second?
Second.
Janetta Williams is a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Let's next recall the matter of Robert Kemple. Mr. Kemple, if you're present, if you would come forward. I've not seen him today, and no one is coming forward. As most, if not all of you will remember, at our last meeting, the September 2022 post-council meeting, the council considered this matter. The council directed that Mr. Kemple's matter be continued until today and asked the division to issue a notice to Mr. Kemple that it intended to seek action against the certification for an additional violation. This time it'd be a violation of 211 sub 1B regarding fitness for duty. The division, after careful consideration, did not issue that second notice of agency action alleging a fitness for duty count against Mr. Kemple. In this case, Mr. Kemple's former agency did not refer Mr. Kemple to the division to take action regarding Mr. Kemple's fitness for duty. That's the typical way by which sub 1B cases are brought before the council. That's the primary method, I should say. Certainly the division can issue a notice of agency action alleging a fitness for duty count when the division develops clear and convincing evidence that the peace officer has a physical or mental disability affecting that peace officer's ability to perform his duties. However, here, when the division's assigned investigator interviewed Mr. Kemple, we weren't able to develop facts that would support an allegation under sub 1B by clear and convincing evidence. We're here in the same posture as we were in September. Let me just give a very brief overview of the allegations in the notice of agency action. Mr. Kemple was arrested for failure to report an accident, open container, DUI, and intoxication. He was ultimately charged with DUI and open container. Mr. Kemple pleaded guilty to an amended charge of impaired driving, and the open container charge was dismissed with prejudice. Mr. Kemple was terminated from UDC as a result of the incident. The charges of DUI and open container were substantiated when the division investigated the facts. At the time of the offense, Mr. Kemple had worked for 6 years for the Department of Corrections. These are categories D and F offenses, respectively. The baseline for D is 12 months, and for F is 3 months. The guideline range is between 3 and 30 months for the category D offense, and a letter of caution to 12 months for the F. Post is recommending 21 months. In this case, I mentioned that Mr. Kemple's employment was terminated. That took place on February 18th of this year, and we're here by way of a waiver, in part to help explain why Post's recommending 21 months, which is above the baseline. The breath alcohol content for Mr. Kemple was 0.235. As you're all aware, there's more nuance and more facts contained in the notice of agency action. I'm happy to answer any questions I can if the council has questions for me.
For the record, Director Noll will recuse himself. Any questions for council?
Clarify, the recommendation is 21 months because in our packet it's listed as 1 year, 9 months.
Which I believe is 21.
You're right. That's true. You know, it's a little bit early in the day.
Tomato, tomato. Right?
There we go. I move we accept the post recommendation.
Did you have a question?
Question? Oh. Yeah. I would encourage us to explore this again. I'm the one that brought this forward at the last meeting. I understand if it doesn't fall under the guidelines of fitness for duty, but I still pause with suicidal attempt and ideation. And I just thought we should explore that, especially before, in 21 months, they could go back in the field.
Which I believe in the past what we've done is made sure that they had a evaluation to make sure that they were suitable to return to duty, as I recall. That's council, is that correct?
I believe.
I'd like to you could motion to add that, at least, if we could.
Would you like to go ahead and make the motion?
A motion to add a fitness of duty test to return.
Second. Do we want a therapist or a clinical psychologist? Is there, I assume there's a difference there?
That's not my forte. Okay.
I think in the past we've gone with a psychologist.
Clinical psychologist.
One thing to consider as well is that this individual will have to
go through a hiring process as well. If he chooses to come back to work, which
I would hope that every agency out there is doing a thorough background, which would include coming here and pulling this notice of agency action, and also doing a complete and thorough background, including a polygraph and a psych. Just as food for thought.
My question is, can we make that motion if he wasn't given the notice?
We'd have to notice him, I believe. Right, counsel? It'd have to be notice of the additional...
Well, he waived based on the recommendation that Post would recommend the 21 months. In Post's duties, it's to choose among the suspend or revoke the certification, so I'm not sure that it's really enforceable for the council to add a criteria for reemployment. I think that's upon what happens when he does apply for reemployment.
Has there been a precedent set on that previously? I know that we've taken that action before. I'm just trying to figure out.
I think that's why we're back here today again, because we had this discussion last time and we decided to table it because he hadn't been noticed. So we'd be doing the same thing over again, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they decided as a division not to do the notice, so I think as a council we're probably done. But I'm not an attorney. I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
That's good.
Well, I'm feeling more comfortable from Director Garcia's explanation of the processes by which you would be rehired to kind of vet officers. So
you I hope can, that's the case.
Right.
I mean, that's the standard practice, but it doesn't guarantee that.
So I can remove that amendment.
All right, does that answer our questions? We have more questions on that.
Would you like to go ahead and make a substitute motion?
Motion to accept the recommendation from Post Council of 21 months.
I have a substitute motion from
Dr. Sween to accept the Post Council recommendation of 21 months. Do I have a second?
Second. Chief Swanson, second. Any further comments? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you.
As my last matter, disciplinary matter, let's call the case of Jennifer Osborne. Ms. Osborne, if you're present, if you come forward. I have not seen her and no one is coming forward now. Ms. Osborne was a post-certified dispatcher with the Department of Public Safety, Cedar Communications Center. She was administratively investigated for a grandma violation. During a Garrity interview with her agency, Ms. Osborne admitted to reviewing police reports, which were protected or private information under grandma, in a law enforcement database containing an individual that her niece was dating. She also admitted to disseminating the information in those reports to her niece and other family members. Ms. Osborne resigned before the conclusion of the administrative investigation. This is a Category E violation. The guideline baseline is 6 months. The range is between a letter of caution and 18 months, and Post is recommending 6 months. In this case, Ms. Osborne resigned. The resignation was effective January 23rd of 2022. We're here by way of default. And I failed to put in my slide, but at the time, Ms. Osborne had 12 years of service. I'd be happy to answer any questions if the council has any.
For the record, Colonel Rappage will recuse himself.
I have a question for the council. I feel like when we've had previous grandma violations that they've been more accessing the information. I feel like with the dissemination, that to me adds an additional element. And I would recommend that we increase to a 12-month suspension based off the fact that information was both accessed inappropriately and disseminated to family members in an inappropriate way.
I'll second.
So you have a motion from Councilperson Stevens to
increase the suspension to a 12-month based off of the fact that the information was also disseminated to additional individuals.
Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Chief Self, any further discussion?
Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Council.
We will now turn the time over to Deputy Director Garcia.
This will also involve Mr. Gadd, so I'll just have Mr. Gadd stay up there, and I'll stay back here. So this was brought up as a point of concern with the Gavin Hanselman situation that you guys saw today. If you recall, last post-council, we talked about the discrepancy or the oversight when the guidelines were amended to reflect the drug changes and how we changed to meet the legal punishment to make it equate to like the classification of violations, so Class B, Class A, to make sure it falls in the correct category. With this Hanselman case, we also noticed another oversight when those changes were made, when changes to 536211 were made by adding 1G. So if you go to your guidelines page, if you recall, Mr. Jorgensen read what the 1G violation is. However, in our notes on page 2 of the guidelines, footnote number 4 says, untruthfulness in an official investigation where the individual has not received a properly administered Garrity warning is not a cause for suspension or revocation under 536211 or 536309. Such untruthfulness, however, may be considered by the council when deliberating a sanction for a violation under either of these statutes. So essentially, this note is in contradiction with state law. So we either need to strike this note or we need to amend the verbiage on the note, which I believe Mr. Gadd is prepared to do either or willing to do either or answer any questions that you might have pertaining to that.
As we looked at this, we thought, you know, what options could we suggest to the council? The first is, of course, get rid of guideline note 4. However, from my perspective, there's a lot to like about it. And so the second suggestion to make is just amending it. In this case, it would be adding the text in red to keep the protections that I think are important in note 4, but make it explicit that for investigations under sub 1G, that note's not applicable.
Is there a circumstance where one would apply and the other one wouldn't? Are they pretty much usually mutually inclusive of one another?
Mr. Hanselman today, I think, was a pretty good example of when the rubber meets the road in this problem. You know, he was investigated, but he was never given Garrity. It was a supervisor trying to get some hijinks to stop, right?
Is asking a question in a briefing setting an official investigation?
As you read the note?
Yeah. I mean, it's untruthfulness in an official investigation. So, I mean, is asking a question in briefing considered? I mean, it's subjective, right? Is that an official investigation?
I would suspect that the division would tell you we would leave that up to the agencies.
I don't want to speak for the division because we've not read the agencies.
Does 1G require an official investigation? And when you read it, it doesn't.
Here, I'll pull it up on the screen. There it is.
Sounds like Garrity needs to be given. Is that correct?
Not for G. For G, basically, you're looking at anything that's even just an inquiry. And I think that was the foundation for the legislation being passed in the first place, was this isn't a question of whether or not they've been given Garrity. This is a question of we need officers to be honest and truthful in all their dealings. And so this was to address those instances where Garrity doesn't catch the dishonesty.
As I read that, it seems to me that as long as the agency has a policy that requires that their officers respond truthfully when questioned by a supervisor, whether it's in a briefing or an official investigation, that code would be in play. My concern with the amendment that you recommended is, to me, that still, the top part of that note contradicts the bottom part of that note. I think my preference would be to eliminate it entirely, because I think that the top part of that note still does not comply with the code as the code has been revised. So if you can help me understand how that's not a contradiction, but as I read through that note as outlined now on the screen, it just seems like it contradicts itself.
I'm trying to think of anything.
Interpretation, I guess. Statute is meaning.
Well, and I kind of agree. I'm a little biased in the Hanselman case because he works for me now. But once he understood it was an official investigation, he went and told. But really, to the sheriff's point, we want everybody to be honest whenever they're asked, whether that's in a briefing setting or in the hallway or whatever. But officers will goof around, they'll mess around, but we need to hold them to a higher standard, and I agree with that. And it is kind of, so the way I read that too, if you do the Garrity warning, you're good. If you don't, then it's kind of foggy. So
that's how I read it too. It's a little ambiguous if you're not reading Garrity.
Let me, if I can try to answer the sheriff's questions. So in my mind, it comes down to, at least in part, where these two paragraphs are found. So on the bottom, this is state code, right? This came from the legislature. This is going to take precedence. It's going to trump anything in our guidelines. So when I read 211.1G, it's not clear to me that the conduct that you would take action on has to be a lie during an official investigation. Well, I think this is more broad. I think it's conduct that involves dishonesty or deception, period, even if no supervisor confronts them. So I'll give you an example without hopefully ruining things. We're reviewing a matter now that will come up, I believe, at a future council meeting where someone was using a government vehicle for personal use. Had that person never been confronted by the supervisor, they're still in violation of a policy. And the way they went about it, by falsifying their driving log, is dishonesty. It's deception. Even though no question took place from that supervisor, I still think it's a violation of 1G. There are most of these instances where there's going to be an investigation, right? I can't imagine us as a division getting a referral from one of your agencies where you hadn't first looked into it, asked the hard questions, and hopefully given Garrity. In those cases, we jump now into the note, right? This note is giving some protection to those officers. That's how I view it. But at the end of the day, these are non-binding guidelines, and this isn't even the guideline. This is a note in the guidelines. And it's saying that you as a council are setting a precedent for yourself that you're going to not... I got to be careful how I say this. You're not going to suspend or revoke on an instance in an official investigation where Garrity wasn't first given based on statements that they made. I don't necessarily see a conflict with the second sentence. So now let me look at the suggested changes, right? Such untruthfulness, however, may be considered by the council when deliberating. I think that's always been true, right? You can consider and should consider all the facts. We try to put as much of the facts as we can into the notice because that's something that you frequently get on defaults and waivers. But even then, you're considering information from the agencies as it relates to aggravators and mitigators. I think that second sentence has always been true. So now looking just at that first sentence with the change that we're suggesting, when it comes to 1G investigations, so dishonesty and deception as it relates to policy of an agency, we're not going to require that Garrity be given before we bring one of those counts against someone. Certainly that's the intent of the legislature, right? When they passed 1G, they wanted us to pursue those. I don't think it makes sense in those instances to require Garrity be given before discipline can take place at the council level, but I like it for all the other subsections in 211 and the companion statute for dispatchers 309. I think there's value in drawing a line in the sand and saying if we're going to take somebody's certification, we want them to have Garrity. It's a noticing to agencies that we expect them to be deliberate in their process, to follow procedures, which I'm sure always include Garrity. However, we started out with two options, and you've suggested the first, that we just get rid of it. I'm not going to have much heartburn if we just get rid of it.
No. So, help me, I'm just trying to clarify this mind, because actually we're dealing with a few of these. So in a matter that doesn't meet the requirement of Note 4 as stated, the predicate would have to be, it would have to be a violation of law or policy. And if it meets one of those, then it's still applicable, even though not as aggravated.
Yeah.
Well, and a violation of Garrity is incredibly aggravated.
Yes.
So what's our maximum sanction for a 1G?
With the guideline note, your maximum sanction is a letter of caution because it's not cause for suspension or revocation.
With the note as it's written.
As it's written. So if you incorporate the language, then you could suspend or revoke. Or if you strike it, then you can still suspend or revoke. So that's essentially saying that the policy violation without the Garrity warning is a maximum letter of caution.
Just throwing out there to flavor the discussion that there are going to be cases come before this body that meet the definition of 1G that are less aggravated than the ones we just listened to.
Agreed.
And then if I could maybe answer, Sheriff, your question more generally, I wonder if you're asking outside of the note, what's our range? If that's the case, then the answer is this is a Category E offense, and it'd be somewhere between a letter and 18 months.
I know now completely, but that's just me.
And I agree. And even with your explanation, which was great, and I appreciate it very much, if I just look at the beginning of that note, it's, to me, it's just not true, right? Untruthfulness in an official investigation under 1G is cause for action. Even in those cases that may have come to the agency for some other part of 536211, once that investigation is started, if that officer is untruthful, 1G now becomes a factor, even though it may not have been at the beginning. So for me, the first part of that note is now just not true.
I don't think the explanation I gave was very good. And more importantly,
it was probably a great explanation. It just takes a while to get through this head here. So.
More importantly, I'm not the agency who's out there working day to day trying to make sense of all this, right? So the first reading is often the reading everyone else is going to give it. And so if that's how you read it, then maybe we should get rid of the note.
Is that a motion?
Motion, unless there's other discussion. I would move that we eliminate that guideline note number 4 from the matrix that we have for the guidelines, disciplinary guidelines.
We have a motion from Sheriff Sparks to remove the note as stated.
A second
from Spence Austin. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for Sheriff.
Does the director have anything that you'd guide us on? Any thoughts here as far as perspective?
Either way, something needed to happen. So it was in contradiction with state statute, with having 1G added. And like Mr. Gatt said, I don't have a preference. Either way, it just needs to be fixed.
So before we, Mr. Chair, where would we default to then? In these matters, what would be the guiding?
It currently exists in Category E in the middle paragraph.
So on that, if you guys recall, when 1G was
first introduced, it was kind of a toss-up of where to put it because we didn't have any cases to compare it to. We didn't have any real baseline because there is a wide range of violations that could fall under 1G from very, very, I don't want to use the term minor, but very jovial and juvenile, like Mr. Hanselman's incident, to something way more severe that just wasn't set under Garrity. So you guys are now trying to set that guideline for G as we get these G cases.
to that point. We will be dealing with something that, because it's a violation of policy, may be from a disciplinary standpoint from an agency as minor as a letter of counsel, you know, just a formal letter, not even formal discipline, but it's still a violation of policy. And once you find that it's in violation of your policy, we're bound by 1G, and it will come before this body. I think a lot of the ability to have discretion and apply appropriate discretion in a very wide range of circumstances we're going to see with this is going to be important.
To note with that, this is where you're going to see, I know we've prided ourselves on being consistent, at least from a post-investigation standpoint, on our recommendations, taking into account previous cases that have been heard before this body. And I know you guys take pride in that as well, as maintaining consistency and treating officers equally and fairly. This is one that's going to be difficult to stay consistent in, and this is possibly one where you're going to see a lot of talk back and forth between representation and officers involved, where, hey, I want you to compare it to this case, not this case. And, you know, you could have a letter of caution all the way up to 18 months with the way it stands now. Or if you guys chose to at any given time to deviate from those guidelines, maybe you end up with one down the road that ends up being a revocation. Now we've got a range from letter of caution to revocation. So it's going to be difficult to navigate. It's just going to be imperative that as a group that we try to maintain consistency as much as possible.
Yes, that leaving it in category E is the right place, because I think it gives us the best possible range, right? It allows us to issue a letter of caution, which doesn't affect somebody's ability to continue working or be certified, or to suspend them for up to 18 months, which would result in their certification being inactive, and they would at least have to come back and recertify through post to go back to work. So I think of all the categories, that probably gives us the best range to deal with those issues as they come forward.
More thought on that than I've actually worked through this a couple of times. The default, the baseline on Garrity violations previously has been revocation, though, right?
That's a category A.
Does it
if fall you in violate Garrity, that falls all the way to
that's
category
that's
A.
That's already A. Or, yeah. Yeah. I'll shut up now.
Any further discussion? Go ahead.
The problem is with G is, lying on the stand or lying in a police report is much more egregious than putting a picture on the copy machine. So that's part of the problem, and maybe we need to go to the legislature and define what would be reported by police departments under G, because the highway patrol gave him 8 hours off in the recent case and handled it. A case we had in the summer where the kid shot his taser on Friday and then on Saturday said it happened on Saturday, was one day off. The agency handled that, and it really didn't need to come here, but because of the legislature, they're funneling everything here, so maybe that's what needs to change, in my opinion. But it's hard to list out A, B, C, D, E, F, you'll report, and the rest you won't. But some stuff can be handled within the agency, in my opinion. So, but I support wiping out guideline note 4 as well.
All right. Anything further? Thank you, Council.
I think we had a motion and a second.
We did.
But I don't believe
did we vote?
A vote.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you. Before we move on to scheduling, I would like to recognize Sheriff Rigby as the new post council director, and certainly thank Alex Garcia as the acting director. He did a phenomenal job in that position. I believe Director Rigby will start in January and will have to step down from post-council. So that being said, the sheriffs will need to come up with a new position for the sheriffs. Do you know specifically what position you're filling right now?
Yeah, for the association.
Okay.
Yeah. There's one that's for a smaller counties and one for a larger counties. But then this position is generally for the association.
DNR
had an additional. Director Royce, please.
Thank you for your time. My name is Todd Royce. I'm the law enforcement director for DNR. I know most of you, and I appreciate the time that you have. given us today. Hopefully we won't take a lot of your time. I talked to Chairperson Carpenter earlier today, or earlier this month, about wildlife law and how it pertains to post and certifications in post, which is, it's very timely that your previous discussion happened, because we're finding some of those issues in wildlife law that can cause some consternation with officers in reporting to post, and also the sanctions by post. What I've done today is I've asked Captain Hovengay from DWR to come and make a quick presentation on how this may affect post and how it may affect certifications. Captain Hovengay is our chief investigator for wildlife. He's a lot smarter than I am, and he is a lot better looking than I am. So I'll turn the time over to him for a minute.
One of those is true. I'll let you decide. Thank you for seeing us today. I appreciate your time. So I've known most of you. I've seen you over the course of the years, but I've been with wildlife for the last 25 years and enjoyed every minute of it. So a couple of talking points I wanted to cover today is wildlife regulations are complex and ever-changing, and that creates a problem in your line of work for what you're doing here today. I want to give you a brief explanation of the breakdowns of the severity of the wildlife statute and the wildlife rules, and then I want to touch base real quick on self-reported wildlife violations as they pertain to official investigations like you deal with. So we have the legislature gives our wildlife board authority to make rules, and these rules are what govern and help us manage wildlife across the state. So these rules are very detailed, they're very complex, and they change every year and sometimes every day. So I thought maybe it would help if I give you some examples of some of our rules. So this is a rule set forth by the Wildlife Board, and if somebody violates this rule, it could be anywhere from an infraction or a statute violation to a Class B misdemeanor and on up. So this is the regulation as it pertains to the bag limits for hunting waterfowl in the state of Utah. Ducks, mergansers, and scaup. The daily bag limit is 7 birds, except for no more than be 2 canvasbacks, no more can be 2 female mallards, no more can be 1 pintail, no more than can be 2 redheads, no more than can be 2 wood ducks, and no more can be 2 scaup. The possession limit is 3 times the daily bag limit. There's a myriad of examples like that in our wildlife rules, which makes it very complex. So so it comes down to the severity of these crimes. It can be changing from season dates, from year to year. Weapon types, what weapons people can use and where. Shooting hours change daily. It's a half an hour prior to, half an hour after sunset, and a half an hour before sunrise, but it depends on which species you're hunting. So I guess in a nutshell, I want you to understand that our DNR officers, our wildlife officers, have to take this into account daily when they're out in the field, and it's hard, and the officer discretion is alive and well. And sometimes our officers off duty law enforcement officers from around the state find themselves in predicaments where true accidents of violation of law can happen. Violation of an infraction, a rule set forth by the Wildlife Board, or a violation of a statute. So the third thing I want to touch on is we see a lot of integrity out there too with off-duty law enforcement officers, and that's a self-reported violation. And I want you to understand, and I just want to educate you on how often that accidental violation can take place when it comes down to the wildlife statues. So does anybody have any questions about that? Our severity of crimes can go everywhere from a third degree felony. We have class B misdemeanors and the infractions, so and class A's. So I'd take any questions that would help alleviate some of your concern for the future.
I maybe just have a question.
Yes.
So I think this body tries to, in all cases, exercise good discretion about what is the appropriate sanction for the violation. I think it becomes more difficult for us when we have a criminal conviction under a statute. It becomes hard for us to set that aside, even though it may be something that's one of these very technical, somewhat more minor violations. So one of the things that, and I don't know if this is as much as a question, it's just a point of conversation, I think this really needs to start with discretion exercised by your officers in the field, knowing that if these circumstances that you speak about, whether or not they warrant a citation or an arrest, because once it gets to the point that we get a conviction, it makes it much more difficult for this body to have to deal with that.
Interesting.
Warnings get sent to us. I mean, we've seen cases where there was no citation, but a warning was issued and it's still a report.
And correct me if I'm wrong, if a warning isn't issued, it would still be up to the responsibility of the agency to notify this council, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to quit hunting ducks.
I have a few other of those examples, but you get the point. So.
And to your point, Carl, I've had a lot of officers
say to me, I'm just not going to big game hunt anymore. Because if I make a mistake, I'm going to become before this post council and I could lose my job over it. So they don't want to risk that. So our hopes is today is to allow, the information and the contact information to go to probably Lieutenant Moore and to the Director Rigby, and to all of you to be able to use Captain Hovengay and Chief Bubak in your investigations of wildlife crimes. Here's one thing that happens. We've got a policy that if you violate any wildlife laws or infractions, you have to report that to your superior in DWR. So you'll see some cases come through in the next couple of months on wildlife violations by our officers. So they're following their policy to report it so that it comes before post council. My thoughts are, probably know that wildlife crimes with officers go severely unreported. It just never happens. Somebody makes a mistake. They think, "Hey, I shot a duck out of season. I'm a day late. I made a mistake. Oh well, moving on." Our officers have to report that by policy. So, our hopes is to help the council and also post investigators kind of sort through the minutia and be able to have officers be able to hunt big game or hunt ducks and know that they can report and self-report and they're not going to lose their job over it. That's our hopes. So,
can we for the next several meetings have a representative from DWR come when we have those, or at least the next several meetings where we have incidents that involve wildlife violations? I think that as kind of to some of the previous points, as we're trying to kind of figure out what this precedent looks like and really gain clarity regarding how we're dealing with that, I think that guidance here to answer questions would be really useful.
Absolutely. I'll get Julie contact information for both Captain Hovengay and Chief Bubak, and you can use them any way that you feel necessary for advisement. We just don't want officers to, one, hesitate in going out and hunting and fishing because they're afraid of that, and two, to not have an officer that makes a mistake lose their certification or get a suspension over a minor infraction or something to that effect. And we're hoping to generate more honesty in that so that they'll self-report more often and so they can work through the process and be more transparent in that. So that's our hopes.
And that happens through the court process too, you know, through adjudication as we whether or not a citation needs to be written or not, it's handled with the county attorney about the intent of the crime and whether it was an intentional violation of law or an accidental violation of law. So
I don't believe infractions need to be reported to this body because that's not a state law, correct?
Well, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that if it's not associated with traffic, then it needs to be. Is that correct?
Yes.
It's just the traffic violations don't come to post, but all other comes to post. And we've had some experiences out in the duck field where we've had off-duty officers say, "Do I need to report this to post?" And we just say you need to let your administration know about it, and that never happens. So. We're kind of a little bit in a quandary on this with wildlife law because it is so complex, and we don't want officers to get in trouble with that. So we want to offer our services to you and also to the law enforcement community to know that you can contact a conservation officer if you've made a mistake, and an honest mistake, that the hammer's not going to come down. And with your guys' expertise, I feel that would not happen, but I know that would not happen, but we just want to offer our services to you, and we can come to post councils whenever one of those are up, because we don't want officers to be treated any differently than the public's treated. So any questions? Any more further questions? Sorry, I get a little long-winded.
Thanks, Director. Appreciate it, both of you.
Thank you.
Anything further before we go to scheduling of our next post-council meeting?
I have a question. Please. So would their wildlife offenses or incidents also follow the guidelines that are here?
Yes. Anything else? With that, let's go ahead and look. Do you have suggested dates?
Probably be beneficial to go more towards the end of January if you guys are for that. As of right now,
speaking with the investigators, they're roughly about 10 cases for sure. There could be more depending on what happens within the next month. So I'm open anytime towards the end of January. Remind me, guys, what days work best for you. If it's Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, what day do we prefer?
We changed the time from 10 to 9. Is there a reason we did that? Just because traffic when you're coming from the north?
I think that was me because on Wednesdays I have council. Okay. And so if we, not, I mean, it's not, it can push a little bit for me if we do Wednesdays. Any other day, I could accommodate that.
Which traffic's, that's okay. I just was curious.
Council meetings just get out of control, and today we're starting at 11:30. So, you know, 11:30 to 7. So, it's just, thank you.
It's a long day.
What's that?
We could even do
How about like a Thursday? What about like a Thursday the 26th at 10?
That works.
26th of January? Mm-hmm. Thursday. That is Sundance, but it gives me a good excuse not to be there.
Well, should we try the 24th instead?
It's 10 days, so no worries.
The 12th would get us before the legislative session starts.
That's
true. Maybe we gotta do that.
The 12th? Do the 31st, too, would be the last Tuesday.
I am in IACP meetings, so I'm out of town.
Yeah, I wish. How did you know? Not Dubai, yeah. How about the 10th? Does that work? Tuesday the 10th, is that bad?
It's not good for me, Tuesday.
Okay.
Was Thursday the 12th proposed?
Yeah, I have training for ICP, so I'm out of town, but I guess Speds could certainly take it.
Which one are you talking?
On the 12th, 12th. January the 12th.
Thursday.
And you'll go ahead and cover
it. You know what? Yeah. Sorry, I'm going to be out too, but I guess I could zoom in if we needed to. If that works for everybody else.
Is the 19th any better?
19th.
19th works.
That works.
That's good.
Okay. 19th.
What time?
10
o'clock.
Oh, just for clarification for Chris, here?
Yes.
Brett?
Okay.
And 10 a.m., is that right?
Okay. So, Deputy Director Garcia and I were talking about threshold and their ability to get cases together in a timely manner for as we've moved this up so that we don't have a massive number of cases. And I'll just have you speak to the issues you're running into.
So, like was mentioned last meeting, it's not necessarily the time between meetings that's affecting us. It's just the amount of time that it takes for us to get a case done and worked through. Minus an investigator. We've been down an investigator since July, so those cases are just continuing to pile up. Obviously, they're being prioritized for those that are, one, either an extreme liability, or two, they're currently employed. But decreasing the amount of time between councils doesn't alleviate that problem. So if you guys are just looking to eliminate the amount of time a council takes and how many cases we're seeing per council, that would be the benefit. Like I said, this one we had, what, 7? January, 10, possibly more. And then we can reevaluate January and see where the investigators are at as to what they would have for the next possible quarter. If you guys feel you need to move it up, we can always move it up, but that's up to the council.
Do we have another investigator in background, or where are we at on that?
Correct. There's an investigator that's in background right now. We hope to have him by the first of the year.
So should we reevaluate after next post-council meeting?
Yeah.
Does that work? All right. Anything further? With that, we will be in recess. Thank you.